Ruff.
Blossom, the clouds have parted. I can see clearly now.
Good. Can you help me get this handcuffs off?
I'll try. Smile, because Jesus loves you, Lieutenant.
Truly, you snake.
Right on, baby. I'm taking your boyfriend here to the White Monkey for another drug therapy session. When he's really addicted, it'll be easy to make him cooperate, just like the late Harold Saunders, huh?
Why do you waste your time doing evil when you know you're going to lose the war?
Oh, we may lose the war, but you're not going to be around to celebrate. Now, we'll just hook you up to this pole, and then I'll unveil my proudest possession.
Anything but that.
This is the latest transistorized torture device. It was designed by a top research team at RCA. The Jefferson Airplane have one just like it, trimmed with redwood. It's as noisy and painful as modern science can make it.
Truly, come here. I have something for you.
Aha, you want to make a deal, eh? What is it? Oh, yeah? Well, that little act of savagery is going to cost you your life. I'll just take Junior with me and leave you to contemplate those stainless steel blades as they inch closer to your throat.
I've had enough of your gloating. Why don't you just get on with it?
Sure. I'll just throw the switch. There. Struggle, sister. Not that it will do you any good.
Help! Help!
I will save you, lady.
The switch! Throw the switch! Oh, thank you, sir. I thought my time had come. But who are you?
No time to talk now, miss. We have work to do. Let's go.
Meanwhile, at the White Monkey Bar, the Dragon Lady has received a telegram signed Mr. Big, saying that Truly and Wrong Q plan to double-cross her. Thanks to this warning from her all-powerful boss, she now plans to turn her former cohorts against each other while accomplishing the destruction of her erstwhile lover, Ambassador Junker. As we look in, she is making final preparations for her evening of villainy.
Because I must have you or no one, and so I'm through with love. Sweetest of all ecstasies, revenge. I have something in store for each of my enemies. First, this special cocktail for the ambassador. It will intoxicate him permanently. And as total paralysis sets in, we can reminisce over bygone days in Singapore. As for Drooly and the general, they will learn the folly of raising their hand against me. I will set those jackals to chasing their own tails until they hang themselves. But I would be in a sorry state if it were not for that timely warning from Mr. Big. I don't even know what my benefactor looks like, always hidden behind that golden mask. After all these years, the faceless one is the only man who has never betrayed me. I wonder if he's good looking. Come in.
Fro, you look ravishing. Is everything set?
Everything.
Oh, you are splendid. How could I even think of abandoning such a woman?
I have disturbing news for you, General.
What? Tell me quickly.
I have received word from Number One. He warns that your agent friend plans to betray you.
Tim Drolly? But that's impossible. What proof have you?
The word of the infallible one.
But Drolly is coming here. What should I do?
That must be up to you. I shall have my hands full with the ambassador.
That white devil!
Come in.
The boy is stashed in a closet, and the ambassador should be on his way. Where's Q?
Here I am, Tim. Come, my friend. Let us retire to the billiard room for a little recreation before the guest of honor arrives.
Okay. I guess we have time for a fast game of eight ball.
After you, Tim. After everything I have done for you.
Don't call me Tim when you shut up.
I'm a creep.
What are you doing to me?
Don't
call me. I'm murder you.
Sounds like a sudden death game. Come in. At last, this must be... Mr. Big?
My dear dragon lady.
Oh, faceless one. Why am I so honored with this unexpected visit?
I came to talk business.
Nothing could give me greater pleasure, or infallible one, but I am expecting a very important guest.
More important than Mr. Big?
But my guest is none other than Ambassador C. Dilsworth Junker. I plan to entertain him in the fashion he deserves.
Very admirable. But why do you have Drooly propped up in the corner? With those glassy eyes, he looks like an exhibit of taxidermy.
Drooly? Oh, curses! He must have come out of the billiard room and I let you in. He's taking the paralyzing drink I intended for the ambassador.
I see. And what's become of the general?
Let's look for him in here. Oh, there he is. Sprawled out on the snooker table. Is that his spear sticking out of him?
No, my dear. Ron Q has been stabbed in the back with a Q. A broken pool cue. How fitting. I congratulate you, Drooly. How's that? Oh, that's easy for you to say.
Well, as you see, I got your telegram.
Telegram? I sent no telegram.
But what about the warning?
However, I do see that you have eliminated two persons who were becoming cumbersome to me. Once more, you have done well. That is why it pains me so much to have to do this.
A gun? But why?
I'm shutting you down, Dragon Lady. It's too complicated trying to operate here in the war zone. I need a fresh start in a more stable marketing area. I'm afraid you no longer fit into my plans.
But you can't do this!
Calm yourself, Drooly, and you too, Dragon Lady. I'm saying farewell to you both. You have served me well, but I have no choice. Any last words, my dear?
Father, got to find him. Where is he?
What's this?
A little surprise I was saving for the ambassador.
The ambassador has been delayed. I'll take the boy.
I know who you are.
Shut up. You're delirious.
You're Mr. Big. You're the real killer.
Let's get out of here.
I won't let you do this. And who sent that damn telegram? I did.
Drop it, Mr. Big. This machine gun could blow your mask and the face behind it into the middle of next week.
Who are you?
A soldier of the People's Liberation Forces.
Blossom, does this mean that you're a communist?
Yes, Lieutenant.
Gosh. Well, if you're a communist, then communism can't be so bad.
Shut up!
You seem very upset at that, oh great one. Why should you care about what the boy thinks unless...
What's behind your mask, Mr. C. Dillsworth Junker?
Dad! Please, son. I know this looks bad, but don't judge me too quickly.
Well, is the American government behind the dope trade? Or is the dope trade behind the American government?
You can understand me, can't you, son?
I can hear you, Dad. Go ahead.
Well, the drug trade is exceedingly profitable. And in these times of monetary crisis, the government does everything it can to encourage profit.
But it's criminal.
Nothing that sells that well is really criminal, son. And there's another side to this drug business. Dope conquers without bullets. It makes a starving man think he's in paradise. From the very beginning, dope has lubricated the Western thrust into Asia. When America moved into the Orient, we moved into the dope trade.
Am I supposed to believe this?
So your anti-drug campaign was just a publicity stunt.
With a solid basis in fact, we are rerouting the product to the mass market.
Where?
The United States. With the war, they discovered a side effect of the drug. It works better on their own people than on ours.
Why?
Counterinsurgency. Which would you rather have? Thousands of unemployed young malcontents, many of them racially disgruntled? Or an efficient pharmacological way of keeping them happy?
But I'm not happy, Dad.
I'm sorry, son, but this is what happens when a powerful weapon falls into the wrong hands.
Are these the wrong hands, Ambassador?
No.
Don't
no.
you dare go near my boy, you disgusting boy!
So bitter. Don't you remember all the good times in Singapore, Dilsey?
Dilsey? Why, that was the nickname she... And your perfume... It's jasmine. Oh, my God. It's you. No, that's impossible.
Life's a shameless playwright, eh, Dilsey?
Yes. Well, here we are. You know, I've been carrying the torch for you for years.
Really? Let me put it out, then.
No.
Come on.
No.
Drop that needle.
No.
Stand up. Are you out in the hall?
Yeah, I am, Mr. Junker.
Disarm the girl while I hold this one. Oh, you're a strong woman, Dragon Lady, but still no match for Mr. Big. And now you'll be my shield as I escape once more.
Shoot, Blossom! Shoot both of us! It would be worth it!
Let go of that needle, Dragon Lady! I'll turn against you!
Dad! You stabbed her in the heart!
Blossom! Your greater victory will be my revenge!
Clyde, get the girl's gun!
No, Dad, you'd kill her too.
Trandog!
No, Mr. Junker, I do not work for you anymore.
What about your rice bowl?
Your rice is very bad. I got sick on it.
I've heard enough. Put up your hands.
Wait, don't shoot, young lady. I know your organization needs money. I own several factories back in the States. Thousands are employed. They'll raise a sizable ransom. In my pockets, you'll find traveler's checks. Take them. Take as much money as you want. You see, I'm in a position to do a lot for your cause. Tell her, Clyde.
He is. He's exactly what you think he is.
I'm a human being, just like you.
Prove it. If we kill him, they would only send another in his place. Our fight is with all of your kind. Come on.
Where are you taking him, Blossom?
Where we can show our peasants whose homes you have destroyed, and your workers whose sons you have taken, and the high school students who are shooting your dope. Show them who the real Mr. Big is.
They'll never believe you. They're too stupid to see the truth.
They get smarter every day. What about you, Clyde?
I seem to be caught in the middle.
There is no middle, only two sides.
Well, then, I'm with you.
Ah, in different countries, the people are fighting one enemy. Some start early, others are slow to understand. But all together, we will sweep our enemy away.
Dragon Lady's Revenge was conceived, written, produced, and directed by the San Francisco Meme Troupe. The radio version was written by Jason Harris and produced by Stan Johnson and Gerard Vanderloon at KPFA in Berkeley. The San Francisco Meme Troupe is a nonprofit corporation organized as a self-governing collective. Any and all communications with the San Francisco Meme Troupe may be sent to the San Francisco Meme Troupe at 450 Alabama Street, San Francisco, California, 94110.
This is Victor Perlo, back on the air after the WBAI marathon. President Nixon, the Pentagon, and the war profiteers are secretly plotting to increase the military budget by tens of billions of dollars to support their extreme escalation of the Vietnam War. This is the unpublished news of the latest events in Indochina. Such an escalation of the military budget will badly damage the U.S. economy and drastically worsen conditions for over 90% of the American people. It will mean huge extra profits for the munitions makers, unless the people halt President Nixon in his tracks. The Pentagon announced on May 11th that it will demand supplementary appropriations of more than $500 million in the remaining month and a half of this fiscal year, and $1 billion more next fiscal year for bombs, shells, and aviation gasoline to supply Nixon's escalated bombing and mining campaign. It will also demand an unspecified amount of extra funds to replace destroyed aircraft. That's in addition to the multi-billion dollar step up already in Nixon's 1973 fiscal year budget. When Johnson started his major escalation in 1965, the Pentagon initially announced that only a little extra money would be required, a mere billion or two. But it ended up getting an extra $30 billion a year for the Vietnam War. Nixon and his gang have the same thing in mind. The May 11th statement uncovers only the first fraction of what they want. Assuming the $500 million of ammunition and petroleum will last the rest of fiscal 1972, continuation of consumption at the same pace in the next fiscal year will come to $4 billion, not a billion. The Pentagon had good reason not to give a dollar figure for aircraft replacements. Because of the vastly improved Vietnamese air defenses and ground successes, U.S. planes and helicopters are being shot out of the sky at a record rate besides being destroyed on the ground. A minimum of 10 per day are being lost through military action directly, through accidents, through multiple damages in combat rendering the aircraft unserviceable for future use. That's 300 per month. The workhorse of the U.S. Air Force is the McDonnell Douglas F-4 Phantom Fighter Bomber. The 1971 selling price was $5 million. As much again must be added for armament, avionics, spare parts, and engines, making a total outlay of $10 million per plane. Considering other types costing less, and the super costly B-52s, we may take the $10 million as an average. At 300 planes per month, that comes to $3 billion a month. Not to speak of the vast arsenals captured by the Liberation Armies from the puppet forces, or turned by the puppet soldiers against their U.S. military masters. If the U.S. continues the air war at its present intensity, plane replacement alone will run to over $30 billion per year, and the total cost will go much higher. The stock market crashed the day after Nixon's escalation speech, but McDonnell Douglas didn't lose an eighth, and then it started up, gaining 7% in the remainder of the week. President James S. McDonnell says he expects profits to continue upward and Phantom production to double by the end of 1973. Thiokol, a leading manufacturer of aircraft shells, also gained 7%. Other munitions makers gained. If this budgetary escalation goes through, it will mean a big increase in taxes imposed on workers, first of all, a further cut in spending for public services and people's well-being, a further increase in poverty and hunger, in dilapidated housing and non-teaching segregated schools, a tightening of the pay board lid on wages, more anti-strike injunctions, more urgent attempts to pass strike-prohibiting and anti-union legislation, a fresh international dollar crisis, and in the opinion of most business experts, a setback to the weakly recovering economy. Every worker affected by soaring living costs and restricted wages faces a cut in real income that makes earlier losses seem like a joke. Thus, 60 million workers and non-managerial employees have a direct bread-and-butter interest in stopping Nixon's escalation and preventing additional military appropriations. Every black, every Chicano, Puerto Rican, Indian, Asian, every poor white, every pensioner, every welfare client, every person needing government-aided low-cost housing, medical care, food stamps, every person striving for a job through government-aided training programs, every student needing government loans, more federal school aid, help for desegregation, all stand to lose essentials for decent living, for a chance in life, and in many cases, for survival. At least 100 million people in these categories have a vital material interest in stopping Nixon's escalation and cutting off more Pentagon billions. Every private or public hired wage and salary employee, every professional, every small businessman and farmer faces financial burdens from a new surge in prices and taxes. Thus, 200 million Americans have a direct pocketbook interest in stopping Nixon's escalation and preventing additional military appropriations, all in addition to the overriding moral political interest. This means all America has an urgent cause to demand of Congress to stop pussyfooting with conditional fund cutoffs. No supplementary appropriations, not a cent, no replacements. Cut off all outstanding Vietnam War appropriations immediately. Let the bombs already dropped be the last. Let the planes used up be the last. Let the additional thousands of Vietnamese civilians murdered in the past weeks by Nixon's marauders be the last. Tens of millions of people should convey the message by wire, phone, letter, and demonstration. Yes, under existing conditions of huge budget deficits and rampant inflation, increased military spending is bad economic medicine. Peaceful settlement can bring with it some good economic medicine. One way, in terms of East-West trade, that's supposed to be one of the big topics Nixon takes up in Moscow. Paul Pauley, assistant director of the Bureau of International Commerce, predicted that the U.S. could boost its exports to the USSR from about $160 million to over $1 billion annually in less than 5 years. This would add 60,000 new jobs in the United States, he claimed. However, he said, this would require U.S. export credit facilities and extending most favored nation tariff treatment to Soviet goods. There have been press predictions that such steps will be taken as part of the package of agreements supposedly wrapped up for signing in Moscow. The Commerce Department represents the increasingly broad manufacturing groups striving to open up markets in socialist countries. It has consistently been the pro-East-West trade gadfly within the Johnson and Nixon administrations. Hitherto, White House and Pentagon resistance has prevented any really major upsurge in U.S. trade with socialist countries. However, the political balance on this issue has shifted. The recession of the last 2 years hit machinery, electronics, and other industries with advanced technology especially hard. Companies in these fields have the best market potential in the socialist countries. In addition, really vast East-West trade deals, especially with the Soviet Union, have been concluded by their European and Japanese rivals. American companies hated to be kept on the periphery of the Tagliati-Grad passenger car construction, and they want a big piece of the Kama River truck plant orders. The old economic warfare arguments don't carry any weight any longer. Nobody thinks anymore that the USSR is a weak sister that will collapse militarily and economically without the privilege of trade with the USA. So delegations of machine tool manufacturers, computer makers, and the like have been besieging Congress and the administration with pleas for opening the doors to trade, painting rosy pictures of the benefits that might flow. Individual companies are striving hard for business, and some are closing significant deals. In the last quarter of 1971, U.S. companies obtained $945 million in licenses for sales to the Kama River truck building project alone. In case you haven't heard about it, this will be the largest single truck manufacturing plant in the world. Of course, these are mere hunting licenses for the business. Only a fraction of that total at best will be obtained. The Rust Engineering Division of Litton Industries is bidding on a $100 million turnkey contract for a huge fastener plant in the Soviet Union to make nuts, bolts, and things like that. It will produce these items for tractors. The Gorky Automobile Factory has displaced General Motors as the largest customer of the Gleason Works, Rochester maker of gear-producing equipment. U.S. trade promotion groups are touring the socialist countries in record numbers. State groups from New York, from Tennessee, and from Texas are included. Until recently, the United States refused to sell up-to-date computers to socialist countries. But Honeywell has just sold two advanced Model 615 computers to the State Bank of the USSR. Agriculture Secretary Butz is trying to line up deals for a long-term sale of grain to the USSR, and other companies are interested in a huge deal for the import of liquefied natural gas from Siberia. The administration tries to give the impression, and probably believes, that it is doing a favor to the Russians by permitting them to trade with us. In fact, the move towards trade is decisively motivated at this time by pressure of U.S. business interests. Miscalculation by the Nixon administration can further delay the opening up of the trade. President Nixon has always been personally opposed to East-West trade, in keeping with his violent anti-communism. Important financial interests remain reluctant to permit business that will speed Soviet technological progress, even if there should be a more serious loss to the U.S. manufacturers in terms of business and to U.S. workers in terms of jobs. There have been hints that Nixon will demand political concessions from the USSR in exchange for trade. In particular, Business Week says, Nixon wants the USSR to help him win in Vietnam in exchange. If the Vietnamese people win, says Business Week, and I quote now, trade progress with Russia could be set back as much as 2 years. President Nixon believes that Moscow needs access to U.S. advanced technology more than the U.S. needs Soviet markets. So he is willing to stick to his position that trade should follow, not precede, the easing of tensions between the two powers. End of quote. Agriculture Secretary Butz, on returning from Moscow, directly demanded the end of Soviet arms shipments to Hanoi as a condition for the sale of U.S. grain. The Soviet Union, even when it was weak economically, never yielded political principles in exchange for trade with capitalist countries. It certainly isn't going to betray the Vietnamese people for the privilege of buying in the United States goods, most of which are available in other countries, goods which may speed Soviet economic progress, but the absence of which cannot stop the rapid growth of Soviet economy, living standards, and military potential. Trade is a two-way proposition benefiting both sides and not a favor done by one side to the other. Nixon's attempts to hold up trade for political concessions can only hurt American business, American workers, and the U.S. balance of payments more than such attempts can slow Soviet development. A couple of announcements. First, as I've said several times before, those of you who would like to get copies of any of these broadcasts of mine, please write Ken Newcomb, Daily World, 205 West 19th Street, New York, 10011. That's Ken Newcomb, Daily World, 205 West 19th Street, New York, 10011. The second announcement relates to the question of East-West trade that I was discussing. Concerns a national conference on American policy towards East and West Germany.